Hello, everybody. How close to this thing do I have to get? All right. So it's been a busy day for me, and I prepared my remarks kind of late, but I think you'll enjoy it. Not really directly related to what I'm saying, but probably worth mentioning. We put up a billboard today that some of you may have heard of or seen. We actually have another one already up. We, about a month and a half ago, over by the Maverick Center, we put up a billboard that says, Bomb Iran, and it's kind of this sarcastic, confusing play to direct people to a website, bombiran.org, where we advocate for not bombing Iran, that, you know, that's something that we shouldn't do. And it was wildly successful. We got a ton of media. We got international coverage of it. We hit CNN's homepage and every local media outlet. So we got a lot of coverage, and it was great. So this one that we did was targeting the LDS population. I'm a member of the LDS Church, and it uses a talk from a previous prophet where he basically, on the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, gave a stinging rebuke of the members of the church saying that we're a warlike people. So we grabbed that line, and it says, we are a warlike people, and then we created a website called warlikepeople.com where it's got that address and a bunch of other ones as well. So that went up today, funded by about 50 people, and controversial as it is, given the prevalence of support of war in this community, we've already gotten some media hit, and that will be fun. So if you haven't seen that already, this is very tangential what I'm going to be talking about, but some asked that I at least mention it. So warlikepeople.com is where you can find out more about that. So I wanted to start out talking today about something that's very fundamental. When I was working on the book that Daniel mentioned last year as I was writing at Latter-day Liberty, it was kind of an interesting endeavor for me to try and distill down some of the more fundamental ideas. And I wanted to, in my own educational process throughout the years, for the past about 7 years ago is when I say that I woke up, my educational process has been very fragmented. I, you know, found this quote here or this historical source here, and it was just a jumbled mess of stuff along the way. And I wanted to be able to provide for people kind of a more concise, compelling, you know, tangible thing that I could say, here, read this. And it was a good exercise for me because I had to kind of gather all these sources and distill them down and kind of start with the most fundamental things and then build on it and kind of walk the person through step by step. As I did, there was an emphasis that I really tried to make with individual rights. And those of you who have read it, some of this will be familiar to it to you, and some of it may be new. There's a quote that I love by H. Berlin Anderson. He was a leader in the LDS Church, but he wrote several political books. Very intelligent guy. And there's one book that I love called Moral Basis of a Free Society. And this quote is derived from that book. He's talking about what basically the purpose and intent of individual rights are, or perhaps better put, what relationship we should have with those rights, how we should defend them and recognize them. So this is kind of how I want to frame my remarks and then lead into some of the other things that I'll discuss. So this is H. Berlin Anderson. One who knows not what his rights are can never know when they are taken and is unable to defend them. He is like a man who believes he owns a piece of ground which his neighbor also claims, but he doesn't know its boundaries. The neighbor continues to encroach further and further onto land he suspects is his, but since he's never certain where the boundary is, he cannot check the advance. Until he takes a firm position and says, this far and no further, there is no line. So he's talking about property, of course, in his example, because it's an easy way to relate what instead refers to rights or is applicable to rights. If we don't understand what our rights are, how can we defend them? Specifically, if we don't understand what our rights are and how or if they may be being violated, how can we oppose that violation? How can we uphold and stand for our rights? So why is it important to understand what our rights are? I think it's because of the boundary that he talks about. If we don't know where those boundaries are, then we have kind of this constant incremental encroachment of those rights, which I think many of you will probably agree that we see in our day, that step by step they're kind of eroded and we're not pushing back, probably because of my assessment that we collectively don't understand what our rights are and we can't say that is a violation, we're going to oppose it. We just see this incremental thing. It's like the story of the camel in the tent, if you guys have heard of that Arabian proverb where it's the sandstorm, I don't remember perfectly, but the camel wants to put his nose in the tent and he asks the guy and the guy tolerates it and little by little the camel continues to invade the tent until he ends up kicking the guy out. And I think that's what we see a lot today, that it's this incremental erosion of our rights or encroachment upon our rights. So I think that illustrates the purpose of understanding where those lines are and drawing them and defending them. It's a problem that I have with conservatism generally. And depending on the audience, sometimes I say that I'm a conservative, but I really don't know what conservatism means, and I don't think most conservatives do. The problem that I have with conservatism is that it's relativistic. Whenever I ask it, not whenever, I shouldn't talk in absolutes. Most of the time when I talk to a conservative and I say, what is conservatism, how do you define it? It's very relative. It's less government or limited government, less taxes, more freedom, more property rights, less and more and less and more. They throw that in so often when they're referring to their rights or the role of government. But it's very relativistic because as government continues to encroach upon their rights, that line is moved, and then their position is always relative to that moving line, if that makes sense. It's not a, they don't talk in absolutes. They don't set boundaries. Again, I'm speaking very generally. But that's a problem, I think, that's kind of a political plague of our day. By no means is it just conservatives. I think we all kind of inherently embrace attitudes that can apply to. So what are your rights? Think about it for a minute. I'm talking to you on the street. Jay Leno's walking up for his little jaywalking segment, and he's trying to make you look like a fool on national TV. And he asks you, "What are your individual rights? Name a few." Think about it. Now, some of them will come easier than others, right? Everyone's probably in their mind regurgitating the Declaration of Independence. But think beyond that. What are some more specific rights? Sure. Another encroachment. That's exactly right. Yeah?
We have freedom of religion, but if you're a Christian church which has hospitals and it turns out if you don't provide, birth control, contraception, whatever, then the government says you're bad, but if you're a Muslim terrorist who defaces the Quran in Afghanistan, you're okay because you're not.
So this is good. We're recognizing these encroachments, and I think that's important. We need to be setting these boundaries. So as I continue my address, think in the back of your mind about what your rights are. Do you understand them, and do you know where the boundaries regarding them are? It's really easy to claim that we have the freedom of religion or speech or what have you and the right to those things, but do you understand where the boundaries regarding those things are? How they're being violated? Are there permissible violations? Is it okay sometimes to give up a portion of those rights? Or are the rights unalienable, which literally means cannot be alienated? You cannot give up that right. It's not inalienable. It's unalienable. Then there's kind of a distinct definition, and I talk about it in my book. So, during the founding era, they really strived to articulate a lot of these rights. The setting of the time, of course, the crown, King of England, had constant encroachments upon their rights. And you may remember the Intolerable Acts. This was in response to the Boston Tea Party. So, founders or those that were in Boston in that area got involved in that. In the Boston Tea Party, and then the Crown retaliated with the Intolerable Acts, where they shut down the port of Boston, right? No more commerce. They basically purged and took over, the Crown did, the local colonial government of Massachusetts, a bunch of other acts and bills that were involved in what are collectively now known as the Intolerable Acts. So the First Continental Congress, in response to these Intolerable Acts, they had what's called the 1774 Declaration and Resolves. And in part, what they said was that they proclaimed that the inhabitants of the colonies were, quote, entitled to life, liberty, and property. Now, that probably sounds familiar because most of it's worked its way into the Declaration of Independence. George Mason, in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, this was in 1776, so a couple years later, he wrote this, in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, as a resolution, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely, the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. So it's interesting. I'm not going to go into a lot more detail. I have some more in my book, but so often we think that the Declaration of Independence was this just radical, remarkable, brand new articulation of our individual rights and kind of the John Locke framework. And that's not really true, because as these examples show and others like them, the founders in the years previous, as they were kind of butting heads with those encroachments, as they were trying to check those encroachments on the boundaries that they had you know, delineated around their rights, they were articulating this stuff, and they were affirming and standing by their rights and saying, this is what we feel we're entitled to, this is what God has given us, you're violating it, and therefore, you know, whatever remedy that they then sought after, which ultimately led to war. Massachusetts, 1780 Constitution, they list the following as unalienable rights. The right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. The U.S. Constitution itself, so often we kind of think the Constitution is this more kind of particular legalese founded upon the principles of the Declaration of Independence, but our rights are enumerated and protected, in theory at least, on that piece of paper, the Constitution. And the Constitution says in the Fifth Amendment that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It establishes for us a boundary. Now, of course, due process with NDAA and everything else has been totally hijacked and ultimately eliminated, but that's the camel sticking its nose further in the tent. But it's really interesting, in these founding documents, you see this association between these rights over and over and over again. Life, liberty, property. Life, liberty, property. And we mention speech and we mention religion, and a lot of these kind of stem out of these three basic fundamental rights. And now you'll recall in the Declaration of Independence that Jefferson said that he didn't write that these were our only rights, life, liberty, and what he referred to as the pursuit of happiness, but that they were among our rights. You'll probably recall that. That those were kind of the essential rights that they wanted to include. But by no means, as the Ninth Amendment states, were they to be all, you know, inclusive and the end sum of all of our rights. So in my book, I call it, and I found a couple sources that kind of labeled it the same, that these three rights, life, liberty, and property, are a sacred triumvirate, basically a three-legged stool, that the stool doesn't stand if one of the legs are missing. The other two cannot exist without the one, and it's a reciprocal relationship. Life, liberty, and property must all be together. So think about it for a minute. Can you have liberty or property if you don't have your life? Right, that's an easy one. If you don't have, let's see, you can't have property if you don't have your life and liberty, if you don't possess the means to generate and acquire and use property. And if you truly don't own your life, you truly do not own your life, excuse me, if you're not free to enjoy it and use it as you please, which is liberty, and manage property along the way. But why do we include property? That's an interesting one that as I was working on the book and as I've talked to people since, I've sensed, at least myself, a little confusion that life and liberty are kind of these easy ones, right? That kind of makes sense and it sounds almost just poetic that of course those are our rights, but why property? You know, is that really a right? And I want to read, just for convenience sake, because rehashing it, I probably wouldn't put it as well as I did because I spent like 4 hours working on these two paragraphs when I wrote the book. I want to read these couple of paragraphs because I think it hopefully explains why property is such an essential right. So I'll read this and then I'll kind of continue on from there. And for those who care, this is on page 120 of my book. The long-standing association of these three rights, again, life, liberty, and property, may give initial credence to the assertion that all must be present for liberty to truly and fully exist. But understanding why this is true is crucial to promoting and defending these God-given unalienable rights. As one's life consists of, at least ideally, good health, productive progress, the acquisition of knowledge, and the security of one's person and effects, it becomes evident that none of these would be possible without property. Indeed, our many other liberties likewise have a close relation to property. We acquire and use property to build churches that we may worship God. We use property in the construction of printing presses and telecommunication infrastructure to use our free speech. We use property to obtain weapons that we might defend ourselves against aggressors. We use property to build automobiles, planes, bicycles, and other methods of transportation so that we can peaceably assemble with whomever we please. In short, our liberties cannot be exercised without the right to acquire, possess, and use property. So remember that sacred triumvirate. If you get rid of property, you cannot fully and realistically enjoy your other liberties. Property is the end result of one's applied labor and belongs to the individual who produced, manufactured, or rightfully obtained it. If another individual, or by extension the government, were to confiscate your property without just cause, then he is likewise stealing a part of your life, as the property represents a certain portion of your life spent in the acquisition or production of that property. Likewise, your liberty would be suppressed in proportional measure, as you would be unable to apply that property to pursue whatever results you may have intended for its use. So I hope that clarifies why property is important. I won't go into detail on life and liberty. I think those are totally obvious, but property is extremely important. And by no means was Jefferson trying to deprecate property by not explicitly including it in the Declaration of Independence. Murray Rothbard, in one of his books, he rightly notes, I think, that it was an expansion of property. It wasn't just a let's exchange property and that's a right. The pursuit of happiness is kind of a more all-encompassing right that definitely includes property. So one thing I wanted to also mention is that life, liberty, and property, while they are all individual, unalienable rights, this was interesting that I had kind of come across as I was working on the book earlier on, that they all represent three spheres of time. Now, and I'll go into each. So property, as I mentioned a second ago, it represents our past, right? The time and the energy and the knowledge that we had to use to generate it or create it or exchange someone for it. It represents a part of our past. Liberty represents our present. It's the ability and opportunity we have to exercise our agency, to apply new time and energy in pursuit of happiness or acquisition of property. And that's liberty. So property is our past, liberty is our present. Life represents our future. It's the opportunity to pursue happiness, to apply both property and our liberties to seek a better life, whatever that may be. Our life is our future. So I think the more that I dug into this in working on the book, and the more I talk about it and discuss it with others, the more I realize how interconnected these rights are and how fundamental they are. Do we understand, given their fundamental nature, where those boundaries around them exist? Upon what circumstances are they violated? When is it justifiable to resist and to reject the camel in the tent or the usurpation? Another question I wanted to pose that I think some people struggle with is, who do these rights belong to, or who gets to enjoy them? So often I think, as Americans especially, we become xenophobic. And by that I mean, you know, us versus them, we're so great. You know, we may not state it that way. Of course we wouldn't, because that would appear xenophobic or racist or what have you. But I sense a lot of undercurrents in politics and what people support, that we do kind of feel that these are our rights, this is, you know, our constitution, it only applies to us. The early 20th century historian, his name was Vernon Parrington, he wrote this regarding the Declaration of Independence, that Thomas Jefferson attempted to extend the concept of rights for all mankind, all over the globe, for all times, not just property holders. So it was a radical thing that Jefferson did. So then we read in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they, all men, are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. So often I think we, perhaps without thinking, support policies that infringe upon the rights of people who happen to live in another country, whether the person or people leading their government are a dictator or not, or they have oil or not, or what have you. We support the violation of their equal individual rights. I think we incorrectly assume that the Constitution only applies to us, it only guarantees our rights, and that is absolutely not true. These are rights that are enjoyed by all people, and any policy that we support, especially at the federal level, because that deals primarily with foreign affairs and international matters, must respect the equally unalienable rights of other people. This is something that Jefferson wrote and recognized that is not an American thing. These are rights around which, again, are certain boundaries, some line hopefully drawn in the sand, that should not be violated without just cause or due process, of course. So that 1780 Constitution that I mentioned earlier in Massachusetts, it was written mostly by John Adams, and he said in there, all men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights. So again, another mention, this is for all men. Now, of course, this was a very budding movement in America. They were incorporating a lot of philosophy from England and some European countries to finally kind of codify it into a brand new government where they could start from scratch. So of course they had the opportunity, and perhaps that leads many to believe that this was kind of a more localized American thing. But I think their vision was greater than that, and they say this in their writings, that this was a very, you know, I think that's why Jefferson was so excited, incorrectly so, ultimately, by what was happening in France at the time. And he thought he saw someone else that was reclaiming and hoping to defend their rights, and that went south, of course. But we need to make sure, I think, that as we talk about what policies we're supporting, that we recognize this is something radical, this is the brotherhood of mankind. That doesn't entail global government or UN or anything like that necessarily. Just that as we empower our government or justify our government or refuse to oppose our government in doing something that it's doing in the violation of the rights of other people, that is equally, in my view, impermissible, just as it would be an infringement upon an American. We think that if the government turns on us, how horrible that is, but when an American soldier, you know, kills 16 or however many people, then collateral damage, or, you know, how would we feel if that was happening in Provo, Utah, or whatever? And that's, I think, where the golden rule really applies. So I wanted to read what Jefferson himself said about the Declaration. I think this was fantastic. And it's, to me, a striking example of how far off we've strayed. This was years after he wrote the Declaration. And I think it was in a letter in private correspondence. But he was discussing why he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And he says his intent was to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent, and to justify ourselves in the independent stand we are compelled to take, neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular and previous writing. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for by the occasion. So what he's saying is this wasn't new. And as I read earlier, there were all these things happening at the state level especially, but then in the Continental Congress as well, where they had been articulating these rights. This existed in different language, but the same ideas had been weaving themselves into the various legislatures and their resolutions and their legislation for years as they began to conflict and really run into the English government. He felt this wasn't something new, but I really find it fascinating that he says that it was intended to be an expression of the American mind. What would today be an expression of the American mind? Would it be anything anywhere close to this, where we have Justice Ginsburg saying that, oh, don't follow our Constitution? She was recommending to others that they follow, you know, South Africa's or these other ones where they're given more rights, codified, and all these government goodies. What would be the expression of the American mind today? And if that is far off course from what Jefferson did, I guess the first question is, why have we deviated so much? And the second question is, what can we do to get us back? I submit that it's those boundaries have been crossed, and we don't need less government and less taxes. We need firm absolutes, where relevant, of course. Sometimes absolutes are more harmful than beneficial. But where relevant, we need absolutes drawn in the sand. And we need to resist any usurpation of rights that infringes upon or exceeds those boundaries. Are we as willing to do it as they were back then? Do we have the, you know, resources and skills and stamina to engage in that type of battle? Now, I'm not advocating open-armed conflict, but I am advocating very ardently resisting those usurpation of rights. I think it's so often, because it's incremental in nature and because there are so many encroachments at once, we kind of get frozen and we don't know quite how to resist or where when we're basically encircled about by these infringements. But think about that and carry that with you. I hope that the expression of the American mind, what would it be today and how far off have we veered off course? So for the latter part of what I want to talk about, now that I've talked a little bit about what these rights are, and their importance, life, liberty, and property. What is government? What's the purpose of government? Why do we even need government? And there's a great quote by John Locke, I think this is in his second treatise, where he says, "The great and chief end of men's uniting into commonwealths or governments and putting themselves under government is the preservation of their property." And recall, of course, that wherever you have property, you have life and liberty as well. They're very interconnected. So we can basically say is the preservation of their individual rights, if I can be so bold as to substitute words for the great John Locke. The great and chief end of uniting into government is the preservation of our rights. What then when the government becomes the usurper and abuser of those rights? Read again in Declaration of Independence what Jefferson said, right? That there is moral justification and authority to resist those usurpations. Again, so that this doesn't get on YouTube, I'm not advocating armed conflict. I am advocating that we recognize those violations and that we push back appropriately, whatever that means to you. But understanding what government is, so John Locke says that that's the purpose and the intent of uniting into governments, is the preservation of our rights. What, though, is government? Many times I think we treat it as this like mythical creature that, you know, has its own distinct form and features and authority. But the government is us. And a government can have no more authority than you or I individually have and can delegate to that government. The only exception to this, which really isn't the form of any government today, is where there is explicit direct consent of everyone under that government, where you can say, okay, we'll have Social Security, but then you have universal agreement by everyone else. To the extent that you don't have the true consent of the governed, we don't have consent of the governed today. That's a myth that many people like to parrot, and it's wildly incorrect. To the extent that you don't have the consent of everyone being governed, not just the majority, then government's legitimate purpose can only be the preservation of our individual rights. It cannot be the violation of those rights, even if the majority agrees. I think we readily recognize the tyranny of the majority, democracy. The founders thought democracy was evil. They founded us on a republic, the rule of law, natural law. What is that? It is the recognition and protection of our individual rights. The mental exercise that I always like to play with people is Lord of the Flies, for those of you who have read. Now, that, of course, didn't turn out so well, and it was kind of nasty parts, and I haven't read it in like 20 years, so I don't remember everything, but what I do remember is they were basically all on their own. There was no government, every man for himself, right? So imagine that situation. Government is gone. No more IRS, no more laws against marijuana, no more speeding tickets. Government is totally gone, and it's just you and I and everyone as neighbors living together. What do we have the moral authority to do in our interactions with one another? Do I have the authority to compel with violence my neighbor to give me some of her property or money to help pay for a doctor that my mother needs for her care? Do I have the right to physically beat my neighbor across the road because he grows and ingests a plant that I think is harmful and sinful and bad? The list goes on. I mean, do I have the authority to, you know, jail in my basement my other neighbor who won't... kind of fun if you think I'd turn that into a movie. Do I have the authority to jail my other neighbor in my basement who won't give me his property to pay for my child's education? Like what Jefferson did, this idea, I think, is very radical. But I think it's only radical in the sense that the expression of the American mind today, the things that we support and believe, are so far gone from a recognition and a defense of these individual rights that we justify and embrace and welcome with open arms at times a government that provides things that we like. We oppose TARP and Obamacare, but we like, you know, Medicaid because our grandma uses it, or public education because someone babysits my kids half the day, or whatever. But this is something that permeates the entire political process. It is a radical notion, I think, of what government is and ought to be. And it is basically tearing down all of government save that which is legitimately defending those boundaries around our individual rights. A man whom I esteem highly, and many of you will likewise esteem, he was a leader in the LDS Church, but he was involved in the U.S. government, Ezra Taft Benson. He said, and I'm 90% paraphrasing, but the gist is correct, that the proper function of the government is limited only to the spheres of activity in which you or I as individuals have the right to act. And this is a quote that isn't very new. I mean, Jefferson said the same thing, and many of the other founders, and I've got that in the book. But I like that quote. I like the way he words it. The proper function of government is limited only to the spheres of activity in which you or I have individuals to act. he, I don't think, perhaps was playing the same mental exercise, but it supports exactly what I was just saying. Get rid of government. What spheres of activity do you and I and all of us as neighbors have the right and the authority to do to one another if government isn't there? Government can only legitimately have the powers that we collectively are able to delegate to the government. We cannot delegate to the government any powers that we ourselves do not possess, right? Because if we say, well, we have the right to, you know, vote for public school over the, you know, vote and the will of 30%, so 70% wins, we've basically voted, you know, to pay ourselves, but we've mandated that the minority pay for the things we want. If government wasn't there, would we have the right to do that? Would we have the right to impose our wills upon other people backed up by what George Washington called force? Government is like fire, is what he said. So it's something that requires a lot of thought, and there's a lot of other mental exercises you can do as well, but I think that's crucial to understand. That I think we readily recognize that the federal government can have no more authority than is outlined in the Constitution, right? That's a very easy benchmark for the federal government. It's a very easy litmus test. What can the federal government do or not do? Let's look to the Constitution. But take it down to the state government, and that's where we all part ways, and libertarians and conservatives and constitutionalists, and there's no agreement. Why? Because people do not have a benchmark or a litmus test for the state government. They perhaps incorrectly think that anything not delegated to the federal government is reserved to the states, and they cite the 10th Amendment, not realizing that it says, or to the people, respectively. States can only retain the powers that they have been legitimately delegated from the people who rule over them. So I want to tie those two things together, and I'll conclude here, because life, liberty, and property, if they are this three-legged stool, this sacred triumvirate, that if you violate any one of those, you're violating the other two. If you're violating my property, stealing my property, whether we call it taxation or you know, whatever you want to call it, for unjust and wrongful purposes through government. If you're infringing upon property, for example, you're infringing upon my life and my liberty. I lack the ability to be as charitable as I want and for the purposes as I want because I'm forced to be charitable to, you know, pay a bankrupt social security system, what have you. So life, liberty, and property, those are the interconnected rights that we all have. They are not exclusive. We have more rights than that. And still, please be thinking about what those are because you need to be drawing your own boundaries around those and recognizing when they're violated and if so and when, what you're going to do about it. But life, liberty, and property being the core ones, core liberties, then as we get into talk about government, which the other speakers I'm sure will, what do we oppose and what do we support? What do we allow the government to do and what do we oppose? And I submit that we need to, in all cases, tear it down, pretend government is gone, and is this something that I can do to you or you if government did not exist? We do not and should not live under a system of democracy where the 99% impose their will on the 1%. Government should only exist, as John Locke said, to protect our property or protect our individual rights, and not usurp it and not violate it. So I leave that, and hope you enjoyed it, and thank you.